Hi there, I'm Jake Humphrey and you're listening to High Performance. Don't forget, we're coming on tour in 2023. If you want to see our brand new live theatre show, just go to thehighperformancepodcast.com. Now, this podcast reminds you that it's within. Your ambition, your purpose, your story are all there. We just help unlock it by turning the lived experiences of the planet's highest performers into your life lessons. So right now, allow myself and Professor Damien Hughes to speak to one of the greatest sports stars on the planet so that he can be your teacher. Today, this awaits you.
I'd never crashed at that speed before, doing 330 kilometres an hour. DRS open, got on a wet patch, the car just spun. I'm going sideways down the track, carbon fibre flying everywhere. I can't see to my right because you're kind of locked in the cockpit. I don't know what I'm going to hit, and I'm sort of bracing for impact. You have to find your own successes. You know, I would celebrate when I was only half a second away from 18th from the grid rather than being a second away, because that was relative success. And for me, that was kind of like a pole position. There is no one path to success. I think you need to find your own path, your own journey. You need to have that self-belief that even if somebody is going down a certain path, you need to follow your own course and you need to do what is best for you.
Oh, I can't tell you what a cool episode this is. Man, this is the truth behind Mercedes Formula One driver, George Russell. I think that we all have an opinion, right, of people who compete at the very top level. And I think all too often in the modern world, we have an opinion that it's easy. Because look at what is in front of us all the time, perfection. Whether it is seeing George Russell beat Lewis Hamilton as he did this season in the same car, which is an amazing achievement, or maybe it's going onto Instagram and seeing people do crazy things that just make them look remarkable, or whether it's going on Facebook and seeing that your friends have shared the latest success in their lives. We're constantly faced with perfection. We're faced with people doing amazing things. We're faced with success everywhere we turn in the modern world. People can't wait to tell us about it. So sometimes we have to stop and realize that the journey to get there has been anything but successful. And you're going to hear from George here about taking huge leaps of faith. You're going to hear from George about really dark times when he thought that maybe his dream of being a Formula One driver wasn't going to happen. You're going to hear why he's learned to say no, which gives him more chance to say yes. You'll hear his opinion on friends, on teammates. You'll hear him talk about those huge moments in Formula One, from almost winning his first race a couple of seasons ago to that moment that he clashed on track with Valtteri Bottas, whose seat he was trying to take in the Mercedes team. It's the most remarkable chat. One thing to tell you, we recorded this about a month ago at a gorgeous hotel just outside London, but it was before George won his first race in Formula One. So on behalf of everyone on the High Performance Podcast, George, huge congratulations on being a Formula One race winner. But let's now get the story behind the guy. This is the truth about how George Russell has ended up as a Formula One race winner on the High Performance Podcast.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
My favorite spring cleaning takeaway is the post-clean clarity that you get. You know, you think, have I really been living like that for so long? It's a bit like when you find out you've been paying a fortune for wireless when Mint Mobile has phone plans for $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan. You just think, wow, how have I been affording to pay so much more? It is time to switch to Mint Mobile and get unlimited talk, text, and data
for $15 a month. And the quality of their mobile service in comparison to your old provider is special. You could be saving so much money. So say goodbye to the overpriced wireless plans, jaw-dropping monthly bills, unexpected overages. You can use your own phone number, bring along all your existing contacts, and ditch overpriced wireless with Mint Mobile's limited time deal, where you get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. So to get this new customer offer and your new 3 month unlimited wireless plan for $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/HPP. That's mintmobile.com/HPP. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/HPP. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3 month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gig on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
Well, George, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Let's start as we always do. What is your version of high performance?
High performance is working hard. I think it's as simple as that. The life we live is all about high performance between, you know, the athlete, the driver in the car, the machine, the car itself, the engine, the tires, and absolutely everything. And everyone within that organization's got to be performing at the top level. So I guess that's it.
So let's talk then about where this understanding of hard work came from. So, like, let's just go backwards a few years before Formula One. Your brother raced in go-karts. And is that sort of where the passion came from? But then the question is, where did the understanding of the hard work and the determination and all of that come from?
Yeah, I think having my brother, who's 11 years older than me, going through his journey, he started karting when he was 11 or 12 years old, which in our world is probably 5 years too late. So he was a bit behind the curve. He was an incredibly talented go-kart driver. He won British championships, he won world championships. But unfortunately for him, they were probably 5 years too late, and he missed that opportunity to go into single seaters and get an opportunity into Formula One. But seeing what he and my father went through, also probably seeing where, you know, he wouldn't mind me saying this, where they sort of fell short and the mistakes he probably made on his journey, I was so fortunate that my family, my parents, and even my brother sort of mentored me and helped me through my journey, helped me to avoid some of these mistakes and recognize, you know, how hard you need to work, the sacrifices you need to put in.
And what were those mistakes?
I don't want to talk anything bad about my brother here, but I don't think he'll mind me saying that, you know, when he went to university and, you know, when you're surrounded by some people who maybe aren't the best influence, drinking, partying, probably doing things that a top athlete shouldn't be.
Yeah, but doing things that a university student does.
Yeah,
that's
exactly
the point. It's like there's no criticism there.
No, absolutely,
there?
Absolutely. And I think this is where I probably recognized when he was 21, 22, 23, and I was sort of on my journey, started being competitive as a 9, 10, 11 year old, seeing that it's not an easy world we live. And if you do want to reach the top, you've got to give it everything. And unfortunately, you just can't go down every single path. You know, you can't go out at the weekends partying and drinking and having fun as a normal sort of teenager if you want to be able to perform on the racetrack at the following weekend.
Wow. So those sacrifices that you saw were being made, were you learning them at quite an easy age when it was easy to make those sacrifices?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I left school when I was 14. And as I was sort of growing up, 15, 16 or 17, I had a few mixed feelings about that. You know, I was pursuing my dream and I felt so fortunate and grateful that I was getting that opportunity to race. I felt like I was missing a bit of a social life, and I saw the friends who I had at school then, you know, having what you would define as sort of fun and enjoying themselves. But I look back now and I feel like that, if I continued in my path with the sort of friends and the group of people who I had around me, that perhaps wouldn't have been the best influence for me to achieve what I wanted to achieve. And I think one thing I've learned from all of that is the people you surround yourself are so, so, so important.
Go on, tell us about that then. So what have you learned about the characters that you allow into your inner circle?
You need to recognize if somebody's bringing positivity or not. And I think having achieved a bit of success, you know, reaching Formula One, you do see people who sort of come out the woodworks and, you know, try and get a piece of that success, or, you know, even if it's something, so, oh, can you get some tickets here or there, or thinking it's so simple. And you sort of think to yourself, well, I've not heard from you in 5, 6, 7 years. And, you know, you weren't there when I went through the struggle. You're sort of there now that I'm succeeding. And I'm always trying to be polite with everybody. So I'd always try and help in a situation like that. But suddenly when it goes a little bit too far and these people are sort of sucking energy away from you, you almost think you don't need people like that in my life. And now I have such a close amount of people around me. I don't have loads of friends. I've probably got a handful of friends who I speak to on a weekly basis. I've got my girlfriend, I've got my family, and that's kind of all I need, really.
It reminds me of, we interviewed Vicky Patterson. She was a lady that sort of made a career in reality TV.
And I may have watched that.
Right, okay, yes.
I may have watched some of that when I was a bit younger.
But she spoke to us really powerfully about what you've just described, and she came up with what she calls the phone test. So how she responds when somebody's name crops up in her phone determines where they are. So some people, she said, light up your life. They were igniters. Some people were draggers.
Yeah.
Because all they're ever phoning for is to want the tickets.
Yeah,
and then she described that the vast majority of people are middle of the roaders, where they don't offer any value, but they don't detract from it either. And that was the way that she determined it. So what is the biggest lesson that you've learned then to be able to keep people at bay that are bringing negativity or just wanting things?
I think you've always got to be polite to everybody. And I never want to be arrogant, or I never like to ignore people or be rude. But I think, as I said, sometimes you've got to look out for yourself and recognize you can't please everybody. You've got to please the people around you. You've got to try and please yourself. But when you try, and I used to struggle at saying no to things. You know, somebody would ask me to do something. Yeah, no problem. You know, can I see you for a cup of coffee? Yeah, no problem. Can we do this? And when I look at my diary in a month's time, it kind of looks quite empty. But, you know, 1 week later, 2 weeks later, suddenly that diary's filling up pretty damn quickly. And I get to the time I think, Christ, I'm going for, you know, a quick cup of coffee with this person, or I'm doing this event, which isn't really adding any value to me, if anything. It's taken away from my performance. This is an opportunity. I could have been in the gym. It's an opportunity. I could have been on the phone with my engineers preparing for an event. And I come away from something like that just feeling a bit more downbeat, a bit more tired, thinking to myself, you know, this is not bringing anything to my life.
Let's wind the clock back and talk about how you ended up in this elite environment. Your brother is go-karting. You're going along. You start racing. You see his mistakes. You then develop this kind of single-minded focus. Can we just go through, you've sort of brushed it off as not a big deal, but walking away from school at 14 is a big deal, because that's kind of like a contract there with everyone in your life where you go, I'm not just going to be a normal kid. I'm going to give up education at 14 years of age. I mean, it feels to me like there's a bit of pressure automatically applied at that point, because it's like, okay, you better make this work.
Yeah, I guess so. I think I always believed that I'd make it to Formula One. I think as a child, you're a bit naive in that regard. When I was probably 11 years old, I believed I could achieve anything. I felt like I could fly to the moon and back easily. And I remember this one race that I said, I'm going to overtake this person on the last lap in this corner, because I felt like I could do it. And it was the most stupid thing ever, but I managed to achieve it. And at that age, I just felt like I could do anything. And that probably played against me as I grew up slightly. And when I left school at 14, I had a similar view that I felt like I could achieve anything in this world. You go out, you win, and you'll be a Formula One world champion before you know it. And it was only when I was 15 or 16 that I started to recognize that life isn't as straightforward as that. You know, you may be very talented, but you need to do a hell of a lot more if you want to make it. The stars need to align, especially in a sport like ours where there's only 20 race seats available. And it's not like there's 20 race seats available every year. There's only one or two race seats available every year for a great driver to come in. A great driver's got to leave. So I was growing up racing against thousands of different kids, all striving for that same goal. Yet every year there's only going to be one or two, if you're lucky, make it to Formula One. And I guess, yeah, when I was 16, I realised...
How did you come to that realisation then?
When I was 15, I had a bit of a tricky year in go-karting. That was probably my worst year in go-karts.
Is that your first year after you'd left education as well?
It was. I then raced my first year in single-seaters in Formula 4. So, you know, that's a small Formula 1 car, effectively bottom of the range when you're 16 to 18 years old. And I won that championship, but I hadn't been picked up from my Formula 1 team. And I was sort of thinking to myself, you know, what do I need to do to get an opportunity with an F1 team? I won this championship, I've won races. I didn't dominate the championship, but I won the championship. And I wasn't getting that break as such. And it was towards the tail end of that year, I thought, this might not work. And that's when, at the end of that season, I got Toto's email and emailed him.
Did you?
Mm.
That's so interesting.
There's two questions here I'm interested in. Is one, how did you process what might have felt to me, if I'm imagining being in your position, a sense of mild panic at this stage that you've gone all in on getting picked up and you're not getting picked up. So how did you handle that? And this email that you sent, I'm fascinated to know, what did you say?
I thought at the age of 16, the world would come to me. And as I said, it was only during that year that I realized they're not looking for me. You've got to go and look for them. You've got to knock on their door. You know, Toto's not going to look at British Formula 4 and say, you know, there's a kid, George Russell here, who's won the championship by a couple of points. We need to sign him. But if I put myself in front of him and talk to him and show him what I'm made of, maybe there's an opportunity. So I remember I was in Abu Dhabi at the time doing a test in Formula 3. I managed to get hold of his email and I thought, I've got nothing to lose. You know, worst case, he doesn't reply, in which case I've lost nothing. Best case, he replies. And I literally just sent him an email. I didn't want to go in too hard. I just said, you know, I'm George Russell. I raced this. It'd be great to meet you and talk about the future potentially. And I think it was a good time to do it as well. I think timing's key. They'd just won the championship. He was standing himself on the podium after the Abu Dhabi.
Was that luck on your part or was that a bit of foresight?
That was luck. But now I look back and I realize, you know, these small things make a difference. You know, you need somebody on the receiving end to be in the right state of mind. If he's having a bad day or he's busy and he sees this, if I sent that email 1 week earlier, which is the Tuesday before the Abu Dhabi Grand Prix, last race of the season, he probably would have seen it and disregarded it. But it was the Tuesday after Abu Dhabi Grand Prix, season's over, he's relaxed, won the championship. You know, here's an opportunity. Oh, this, you know, this kid's just emailed me. And I sent this email, I think it was about 9 PM, and he replied within 15 minutes with his PA's copied in saying, "Hi, George, nice to hear from you. And it'd be great to meet you in January." And 4 weeks later, I sat in his office.
And what was said that day?
To be honest, not a lot was said that day. I told him about my career. He asked a lot of questions. He was obviously very, very nice and gave me a lot of time. And I think something I've realized about Toto since day one, he gives everybody a huge amount of time. But it wasn't as simple as, all right, we're going to sign you today. And that's that. We left that conversation saying, right, I'm now going to race in Formula 3. This is where you're taking the next step. You know, we'll keep an eye on you and we'll stay in touch and we'll go from there. And it was only at the end of 2015 where we picked up the conversation again. And that's when I signed for Mercedes.
And what did you do in that intervening period? Because I think this is, again, valuable for people who are never going to race in motorsport, but have got an ambition and they know where they want to go. What did you do to stay on his radar? Like to kind of almost let him feel that he was part of your career even before you were signed. Do you know what I mean? Rather than just disappearing for a year and reappearing, which I think some people would do.
Yeah, so he actually gave me some advice to join a certain team in Formula 3. So this was a German team who raced with a Mercedes engine, obviously Mercedes backed, and I think it'd be a great place for you. So I said, I appreciate your opinion, and I went and did a test with them. And I ended up joining a British team called Carlin with a Volkswagen engine. So as soon as I signed with Carlin, I sent Toto an email just saying, I really thanked your advice, did a test with the German team, but I felt like joining the British team with the VW engine would be better for my future progress. And I feel like I'd learn more with the British team than with the German team. And he replied again straight away saying, you know, I sort of jokingly, I think you're making a wrong decision, but best of luck, let's stay in touch and let's see how he gets on. So I think having that follow-up email where it wasn't so formal in a way, it was a bit more informal, and I'd almost gone against what he had advised, he probably saw that it's quite intriguing. You know, there's you know, this 17-year-old kid now, 16-year-old kid, who has almost gone in the opposite direction to what he advised. And that was it until, I think, until December, when there was an award ceremony and Tota was there. And I thought, oh, this is my opportunity to go and speak with him again. And that's where it started.
So it sounds to me like you've started to pull on a golden thread almost, where it gives you a line of sight of, I know where I want to get to now. And it gives you a sense of direction. How frequently, when you made a decision, whether it's the team that you're joining Formula 3 or it, like a particular decision about a race and how you're going to respond, were you thinking about what you were going to say to Toto or what Mercedes would perceive?
Going into that season, I just thought it's all results-based. I've almost done the groundwork now. I've put in those foundations with Mercedes, with Toto. I just need to go out there and perform. Even though there wasn't a contract on the table straight away, I felt like I had a good relationship with him. And having performed, it gives you a lot of ammunition to argue your case. So I think you got to go out there, make your point, then almost leave it and then do the talking on the track or whatever industry it is you're in.
But also a real belief in the decisions you're making. Like, are you doing all this at this point? Or is your dad going, George, send another email to Toto? Or your mum, while she's, you know, chatting to you at the dinner table, she's going, have you messaged that guy from Mercedes again? Or are you kind of, again, as we've spoken about a couple of times already, in a kind of, in your own world, controlling your own destiny?
Yeah, to be honest, most of this came from my own thoughts, yeah. Really, but I'm sure it's from the way I've been brought up from my parents. And I guess they always taught me, you got to go out there and make it happen for yourself. So even though it wasn't my father saying, you know, send this email to Toto, I was sort of on my own accord going out there and trying to create these opportunities. And as I said, it was only when I was 16, I recognized if I want to achieve my dream. And it wasn't just my dream, it was also my family's dream. There'd been so much sacrifice for my father, for my mother. You know, my father used to work every day, you know, 7:30 till 7:30. Never saw him through the week. On a Friday night, we'd jump in the camper van, driving up and down the UK. And as a child, you don't really comprehend what's going on here. You know, why is dad not home for dinner tonight and tomorrow night and the day after? He's there working his socks off to, you know, put food on the table, make a living to be able to afford to go go-kart racing. It's not straightforward. And as I said, by that age of 16, I'd won again in Formula 4, but didn't really have the money to go and race in Formula 3. If I didn't have sponsorship, that could have been the end of a journey. So it's sort of now and in my court thinking, I've got to go and do something because clearly winning isn't just enough.
And what did that do in terms of your perception of pressure? So as you say, like you almost were naive to not appreciate, never seeing your dad. And it's just the way things are. And then you say that realization dawns of, shit, he's been working hard to give me these opportunities.
Yeah, I don't really know how that played on me in terms of that additional pressure. I think for sure my father was very hard on me during my whole racing career.
Go on, what do you mean by that?
And we're just, in go-karting, you've got, my father was my mechanic throughout my go-kart career. My mum used to write down all of the data on her little notepad, all the setups, all the lap times, everything logged in this £1.50 notepad from WH Smith or whatever. And it was so passionate for all of us. And, you know, they're standing on the sidelines, they're seeing me racing, seeing me succeed, but equally if I'm ever making a mistake. Because I think he was going through a lot of pressure. You know, work was not straightforward for him. All of that time and sacrifice he was making, if ever he saw his son going out there and not putting in the effort, you know, during the race weekend, or, you know, I'm more interested playing football with my mates in between the sessions or messing around, I guess that would probably wind him up quite a lot. And he would let me know about it because, you know, he's putting all this effort in for a reason. I need to go out there and show that it's worth it. And I can't be there dicking around, just having a good time when kind of we're here to win.
But then does that affect the father-son dynamic? Is it more than coach athlete?
Yeah, I think so. I probably didn't have the greatest relationship with my father through those karting days because we were like a race team. It was almost like we weren't there to have a good time. We were kind of there to win. And if we won, we had a good time, of course. And we'd always, remember, we'd always stop off at KFC on the way home if ever we won a race. And as a kid, you know, I really enjoyed that. So that was kind of my reward at the end of a weekend if you did a good job. And obviously those moments are so special, but equally on the flip side, if it doesn't go to plan, you know, I felt it, but then I would see it affecting my father and, you know, my mother maybe less so. But yeah, for sure that added... Yeah, added an element of pressure. And that's probably why when I got to a maturer age, you know, 16 and realizing, right, my father has been through not just 10 years of this with me, it's 10 years prior with my brother as well. You know, this is 20 years worth of, you know, passion and hard work. I need to almost pull my finger out now and almost not let them down.
And that's probably why even today, when you don't have a great race weekend, you don't go out and have some food with people. You kind of do, I guess, what you learned really in that period in your life, which was, you know, to try and process that. So it's been so interesting to hear that, you know, people think stuff comes for free. If you've got talent, you'll get into Formula One, right? That's clearly not the case here. You know, you've had to make these sacrifices, have various little moments along the way where you've had to make the right decision, and you do, and you end up in Formula One. And I remember watching from afar, because this was interesting for me, because obviously I was doing bits and pieces with Formula One as you were starting out on your journey. And then I watched you come through, and, you know, you were the most successful young British driver for a period when there were some great British drivers. Alex Albon was, you know, based in the UK, racing under a Thai flag. Lando Norris, obviously, at the same time. So I then remember watching your first season at Williams, but those guys are in a Red Bull and a McLaren and a... picking up points, picking up podiums, and you're not. I'd love to know how that felt and how you processed that from being, as you described, as a young guy, like you just won everything. That's what you did, and suddenly you weren't.
Yeah, that was a really unique season for me, my first year in Formula One, joining Williams and a team that was on the brink of bankruptcy. And it was a team of every single race weekend, it was racing to survive. It wasn't racing to perform. The team was racing to survive and the 800 people's jobs at stake. And there was no doubt, you know, when I got to the first race in Australia, I'm here in Formula One, you know, almost one dream accomplished, and go out on track and we're 4 seconds off the pace, the car's falling apart and we're being lapped two or three times. Kind of thinking to yourself, you know, is this the dream? But I think I've always had quite a rational view to things, and while seeing Alex in Red Bull scoring podiums and, you know, being the man to a degree, and Lando equally always in the points, and that was sort of difficult to digest because I'd just come from Formula 2 where I beat them, and now, you know, I've almost just been put
in. How did you digest it?
I thought that even though they're finishing the points and they're scoring podiums, I'm not here to score points or podiums. I'm here to win, and I want to win. And even though they were finishing ahead of me, we're all going through this journey together, learning. I was part of Mercedes, and I felt like my time will come. So I think every time you, from a difficult situation, you've got to try and look at the positives from it. I was driving at the back of a grid, kind of under the radar. I was making a few mistakes that season, but not many people noticed because people weren't. The spotlight wasn't on me. You know, the spotlight was on the guys at the front. Equally, the spotlight was on Lando and Alex. And if ever they made a mistake, the whole world knew about it. So I saw this as an opportunity that, you know, I'm in Formula One, going to 21 different countries, 21 different races, different circuits. This is my opportunity to learn and perhaps try things that, for example, Alex and Lando didn't have the opportunity to, because the spotlight was on. Yeah. Every single weekend was...
But also, you couldn't have done these things either, because you in previous seasons were racing for titles and championships every year. So you had no exploration behind the wheel, did you?
No, absolutely. I think, and that was a real mentality change for me. I had a teammate in Robert Kubica, who had a horrific accident in 2011, I think it was. And he'd been out of an F1 car for a long, long time. And he had a very difficult season. So I was almost racing in no man's land But there was this one race in Monaco. I was driving around. I was ahead of Robert by quite a margin. I was behind the next gaggle of cars. And I kind of thought to myself, I'm just going to bring the car home because what's the point in risking it? You know, I've kind of achieved all I can in this race. I can't beat the cars ahead. I've already beaten the car behind. And there was a moment in that race that I thought, this will teach me nothing. If I just drive around for the next hour and a half, just bringing the car home, this isn't going to help me in 1 year time, 2 years time, 3 years time. If ever I'm racing for a Mercedes, if ever I'm racing for a race win or world championships. So I just sort of turned up and just went absolutely flat out every single lap around Monaco, kind of risking everything for 19th position on the grid, because I felt like that's what I needed to do if I wanted to learn and progress. And it's from that moment on for the rest of the season that sort of every single race, every single qualifying, every single session was this opportunity for me to build a, you know, greater toolbox of experience for me to tap into whenever I needed it in the future.
I love that, because that's something that, as I'm listening to it, is the first time you're almost driving without pressure because there's no expectation on you as has previously come. And then you find pressure within, you put yourself under some kind of pressure.
Yeah, I was racing against myself.
Yeah.
You know, I stopped thinking about my teammate and I stopped thinking about everyone else because we were so far behind, we couldn't compete with anybody else. So I was purely competing with myself, and I'd have races or sessions where I finished 19th. I was ahead of my teammate, behind everyone else. But I was really disappointed with my performance because I knew I could have done better. And for some of my team at the time, was a little bit difficult to understand. You know, on paper, I'd finished in the same place as I finished last race. All of those boxes were ticked, but I knew I could have done better. And I think that's really helped me to develop from a, you know, this difficult situation. I could have done that whole season just tootled around and I'd have got to the following year. Then I'm slightly more in the game, but I've just wasted a whole season. So I think every single opportunity you've got to make the most of it.
So tell us then, what did you learn about yourself in this season of discovery and exploring your own limits? What's the biggest lesson that came out from that?
I think the biggest lesson was probably success is all relative. You know, when I grew up as a young go-kart driver and going through the ranks of F4 to F2, success was being on pole position and winning. And when I got to Formula One, that just was not achievable in the Williams in that season. So I couldn't come away from every single weekend being disappointed with myself because I've not been on pole and I've not won the race. You have to readjust your expectations and you have to find your own successes. You know, I would celebrate when I was only half a second away from 18th on the grid rather than being a second away, because that was relative success. And for me, that was kind of like a pole position. And if I didn't celebrate those moments, that 21 race season would have felt incredibly long. And that helped me to sort of get through that season and to progress as a driver.
Are you glad that you had it?
I think so. I never want to look back and say things should have been different. I think every single opportunity, every single year, whether it's a good year or a bad year, adds to your sort of development. And it made me who I am. If I was in a Mercedes fighting for victories, I wouldn't have had those experiences. And I have probably been through, in that regard, maybe more than what, you know, Alex or Lando has. Lando's been at McLaren now for 5 years. He's been fighting for the odd podium or pole position for 5 years now, whereas I've been on sort of every end of the spectrum.
Yeah.
And you've got to see that as an advantage. You know, he hasn't been right at the back of the grid, but equally, he's not been right at the front of the grid in McLaren, and it's no through no fault of his own. You know, Lando's an exceptional driver, but you know, that's an advantage I've got to take from that.
Yeah,
I mean, I think what you're describing there is fascinating. There's research on this that your brain respond like releases the chemicals to celebrate whatever your expectations are. So if you expect to get half a second quicker and you do it, your brain releases the same chemical because you've hit your target.
Well, so if your target was to win the world title, you'd get the same chemical release
as half a second
where George
faster.
Was finishing at that point, right?
Yeah. So how do you deal with like setting micro targets now
I never like to look too far ahead. I like to take every single day as it comes. And I believe that if I perform to my very best today, if I perform to my very best tomorrow, whether that's in the gym, whether that's, you know, talking with you guys, whether that's talking to my engineers, whether that's in the simulator, whether that's a Friday practice session, if I do the best job possible that I can do every single day, I'll achieve that overall goal. So it's obvious I want to be a world champion. It's too obvious to even set that as a goal, because that's what we're all here to do. You know, my goal was to wake up today and make sure that I do everything right and go to bed thinking I couldn't have done more than I've done. And if I achieve that every single day, that goal of world champion will come.
So we had a really interesting conversation with Johnny Wilkinson. What year were you born?
98.
So do you remember England winning the Rugby World Cup? You were 5 years old. You were young.
I don't remember it, but I've
you know the moment.
I know the moment.
How long do you reckon he said the thrill lasted?
I think I listened to his podcast.
So it's 30 seconds, right?
Yeah.
And what was really interesting with that conversation was that was the moment where he realised that life isn't about having that moment where the light shines and you're the world champion and then suddenly you're happy. That's delaying happiness till you get to that moment. And I think what you're talking about here is you've realised, as he has, but he only realised it after setting that huge goal, achieving it and realising it wasn't actually going to give him a thrill or any length of fulfilment. It's about being totally in the moment all the time. So, you know, when we're having this conversation, you can give it 50%, but it won't fulfil us, it won't fulfil you, it won't fulfil anyone. And then you go on to the next thing, and if you give that kind of 50%, because all you're thinking about is winning the world title, your whole life will be missed opportunities, flat experiences,
absolutely
dull moments. And then guess what? If you don't win the world title, what a waste it's been changing everything for that moment. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. And I'll always remember, I got obviously such an opportunity when I jumped in for Lewis in 2020, when obviously he came down with COVID. And jumped in last minute into the Mercedes. They'd already won the world championship. That was probably their most dominant race car they ever produced. And I'm coming from a Williams that I was finishing 19th every single race weekend, didn't score any points. Thrown into that car, and I qualified second, 20 milliseconds behind my teammate, and I was disappointed. And that was just such a learning for me, thinking, you know, this is my best qualifying. I've never qualified inside the top 10. I've just missed out on pole position by 20 milliseconds, and I'm disappointed with that. Because for me, I felt like I could have done better. The expectation had changed. And even though that was by far better than anything I'd achieved previously, it wasn't all that.
When did you realise that? Is this a long period after, or is that at the time you thought, why am I feeling like this?
Well, straight away, I was disappointed with second. And it was probably that evening I realised that winning probably isn't everything in terms of fulfilling that happiness. I want to win more than anything. But if you're going out there to achieve happiness, winning will give that to you for a short period of time. But that's, you win once, you want to win two times, you win two times, you want to win three times. It's never ending. And I think that's what I've learned on this journey, and why maybe those 3 years at Williams for me, I dealt with quite well, because as I said, I wanted to be a world champion, and seeing sort of my rivals in Alex and Lando having relatively a bit more success in the interim, they weren't winning either. And they'd already been content with their points finishes. They'd finished in the points almost every single race. They were disappointed with not getting podiums. Then Alex scored a few podiums. He's then disappointed that he's not winning. And I think it's never going to stop. You know, I'm yet to win a race, and I'm working my ass off to try and win a race. You know, when I win one race, I'm not going to say that's my life fulfilled. Yeah. It's, you know, I want to win another race and another race. And then it's, I want to win the championship. When you win one championship, you want to win another championship. So you need to find that way of balancing professional life and trying to get that success, but also trying to find your happiness.
Yeah.
Potentially somewhere else as well, because it's probably, if you're looking for that in your profession and just from pure success, I don't think you're going to achieve it.
I think that's a fascinating insight to reach, because especially I'm thinking of, you've left school at 14. There may be lessons that you learn by doing exams or going through a process like that, or less bruising experiences like your first girlfriend or like falling out with a group of friends at school, and yet you're having to learn this in the bright lights of Formula One.
Yeah, I think leaving school at 14 had its pros and cons. I obviously, so as I said, leaving that social life and people of the same age as me and friends was obviously difficult. But then I was always surrounded by people who were in their mid to late 20s. You know, my when I was racing professionally go-karting, my go-kart mechanics when I was in Formula 4, my race engineer who was, you know, 50 years old, dealing with people at such a young age who have experienced so much in life, experienced so much within that sport. And you didn't necessarily have the bad influence around to mess about. I was terrible at school. I used to always sit at the back and mess around with my friends. Whereas if I was in that classroom on my own directly with the teacher, I wouldn't have been doing that. And I'd have been so focused in educating myself and trying to be a better person. And that was kind of going from one extreme to a kid who's now working hard with his, you know, 50-year-old engineer to try and be a better racing driver, and going, you know, for dinner with him and the mechanics who are in their 30s or late 20s, who are living a very different life to what I would have been living at the age of 14 and 15.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Today's show is brought to you in association with Mindlift, the most personalized brain training app that can help improve your focus and your relaxation. So Mindlift is neuroscience based. And what I love about Mindlift, I've been using it for a while now, is that it's totally personalized to me. So if you're interested in optimizing your health, I would recommend you check out Mindlift. And don't just take my word for it. Take the word of the elite athletes and the industry leaders who use it. So Mindlift accesses brain sensing technology, games and videos that correspond to your brain's activity. Honestly, it's fascinating. You wear a smart headband which measures your brain activity and gets you a personalized routine to sharpen your mental fitness. I've been using it first thing in the morning, and genuinely, when I go into early meetings or I've got lots happening in a day, I notice the difference. I'd love you to start your personalized program at mindlift.com/high performance, and you will get $40 off your first subscription. That's mindlift.com/high performance.
My favorite spring cleaning takeaway is the post-clean clarity that you get. You know, you think, have I really been living like that for so long? It's a bit like when you find out you've been paying a fortune for wireless when Mint Mobile has phone plans for $15 a month when you purchase a 3-month plan. You just think, wow, how have I been affording to pay so much more? It is time to switch to Mint Mobile and get unlimited talk, text and data for $15 a month. And the quality of their mobile service in comparison to your old provider is special. You could be saving so much money. So say goodbye to your overpriced wireless plans, jaw-dropping monthly bills, unexpected overages. You can use your own phone number, bring along all your existing contacts, and ditch overpriced wireless with Mint Mobile's limited time deal, where you get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. So to get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/HPP. That's mintmobile.com/HPP. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/HPP. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gig on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
So you've had qualifying in the Mercedes, you finished second. Thankfully, you've processed the fact that's not a failure and, you know, you can be happy at all times regardless of what's happening. But then comes race day. And that amazing start you had where you sent it down the inside of Valtteri and took the lead in that race. Could you talk us through the process you went through that evening after you'd processed qualifying? that morning, and how conscious was the decision that that's how you were going to start the race? You know, you were going to kind of almost like lay a marker down in that moment against a guy who, let's be clear, you wanted his seat, right? And this was the first chance in your whole career to be judged against him.
Yeah. I think that whole weekend I went in with the mentality that I've got nothing to lose. You know, he's the driver who's been in that car for 4 years now, done the whole season in that race car. This is his 17th race of the season, I think it was. I'm coming in, got called up on a Wednesday afternoon. If I finish behind him, I'm expected to finish behind him because of the circumstances. But if I beat him, that's huge. And that, I think, fueled my motivation of thinking, wow, what an opportunity. I've got nothing to lose and I can just go for it. And I think waking up on Sunday morning, I just think it's just another race. Even though this was the biggest race of my career at that point, it was just another race. And I think that's something I've tried to take forward is every race, you can't build it up into something that's more than what it is. You do these practice days, you do your training sessions, you go through that process. And if you're going to qualify and all hyped up, this is qualifying, I need to go out there, this is the biggest qualifying of my career, I feel a bit anxious and a bit tight and a bit stressed in that scenario, whereas I treat it like a practice session. You know, every training session I do, every practice session I do, I'm trying to be the best I can. I'm trying to drive as fast as I can. So when I get to qualifying now, I'm just going to do the same as what I did in training. When I get to the race now, I'm going to do the same as what I did in training because I train to do the very best possible. So as soon as the helmet was on and you're on that starting grid, there was no one in front of me other than obviously my teammate in Valtteri, but there was no cars directly ahead. It just felt like another race. And it was incredible how that mentality was, you know, you're just looking at those start lights. I've got to make a good start and I've got to try and overtake at turn one. And that's the exact same mentality as I had from starting second there on pole position at one of the races this year, or when I was starting last with Williams.
I think there's something about intentionality here though as well, because I'm reminded as you're describing that experience you said when you were 14 and you went, I'm going to beat that guy in the last lap, where you're going in and imposing yourself on a situation. So although you're calm because it's just another race, there's something about imposing yourself and imposing your will on a situation. How conscious was that you're now in a place where you can go in and impose yourself on that race?
I think you recognize certain circumstances are obviously bigger than others and you want to try and do big things. So I knew if I've got half an opportunity, I'm absolutely going to go for it because that is the moment where the spotlight truly is on. Even though you'd go in with the same mentality when the spotlight wasn't, that you realize, you know, you've got to go for that opportunity as such. And as I said, as soon as you launch off the line and you see half an opportunity, you know, this is the guy who I'm battling for that race seat. I can't leave anything off the table and I don't want to come away with any regrets. It was a very unique circumstance to be in. And especially, yeah, as I said, you know, battling directly with the guy you're trying to take his seat from.
Well, it felt like a fairy tale. I remember at the time thinking, this guy's been supported by Mercedes, he's done the hard yards, he's been in the Williams. This strange opportunity has come about because of a global pandemic that's, you know, struck down one of the drivers. Now he's in the lead. This was always meant to be. But that's not the way this story
ended. No, it didn't quite pan out that way. You know, I got a puncher in that race. Effectively lost a victory through a puncher, but by having that puncher in the race, it also gave me an opportunity to carve my way back through the field and overtake Valtteri again, which in a way was almost a bigger statement than what it would have been had I just won the race and cleared off into the distance. And I obviously finished that race incredibly disappointed and upset that I wasn't standing on the top step of that podium. But probably within 24 hours, I thought perhaps this is a blessing in disguise. You know, I had such an opportunity to show what I was capable of. I think if I just went out there and won that race, probably the respect wouldn't have been there because it almost would have been too easy. Whereas people saw me fight for every single opportunity. They saw me fight at the start. They saw me fight back through the field. I saw that passion of when I got the puncher, and it felt like the people watching was on that journey with me. That was 2 years ago. It feels like yesterday. But if I won that race, I'd have been a one-time Formula One winner. It would not have changed anything for me. And even though it would have meant the world at the time, I'm here to try and be a Formula One world champion. And I would be no happier or sadder today had I won that race. So it was quite an intriguing thought.
You might not want to answer this with total honesty, but I'd love it if you did. Did you think that the performance you put in that day meant at the end of the season you'd be in that Mercedes?
I always believed I'd be in the Mercedes, and Toto made it very clear, just go out, perform, and leave the rest to me. And that wasn't that weekend, that was throughout my whole career. When I was racing in Formula 3, he said, go and win, I'll sort the rest. I won, he sorted the rest, I raced F2. Go and win, and you'll be in F1 next year. I won, and I was in F1, and he had the same mentality. He knew I wanted to be in a Mercedes. Mercedes was the seat that every single F1 driver wanted to be in. And he made it clear, go and perform, and you'll be in the car.
But you did perform, and you didn't.
Well, I had a three-year contract with Williams. That was probably the biggest difficulty, is when we signed for Williams, they were a team who were fighting for podiums, fighting for pole positions. They had one bad year in 2018, but we thought that was, a one-off, and they'd be back to not winning ways, but, fighting in that mid-pack. And Claire Williams, who ran the team at the time, she kind of had us by the balls, let's say. And, that was the only opportunity to get into Formula One. That was the last remaining seat. She basically said it's 3 years or nothing.
Right.
So you obviously went for it. And we thought at the time, 3 years with Williams, it's not going to be a bad place, because, they've been fighting for podiums for the previous 4 years. They had a bad year in 2018, but it's a new season. They could be back to some good ways. And then we soon learned that it was a difficult situation for the team, and they had difficulty with sponsorship. They had a sponsor pull out. The pandemic came, and as I said, it was a battle of survival for them.
But it would have been hard, I imagine, and correct me if I'm wrong, to get that, your first ever taste of a competitive Formula One car, and then go back, not just for a few more races, but an entire season, like, hungry, man, like, wanting that back all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. Once you got that opportunity, it motivates you to fight even harder, to make sure you're there always. And I remember the first time I ever drove a Formula One car was when I was 17 years old. That speed and thrill I got from experiencing that Formula One car, I always wanted to be a Formula One driver, but I had added motivation and fire within my stomach to achieve that, because that was just such an awesome experience. And the same with almost being on pole. That was such an experience and what I'd almost dreamt of my whole life. I wanted that every single weekend. So, I went out the following year, and 2021 was probably my most competitive year in Formula One.
But obviously that was the year when you had that coming together with Valtteri, right?
Mm.
What happened when you stood in for Lewis was kind of out of your control and was great for you.
Yeah.
And I think the general perception was that moment wasn't great for you. How was it from your perspective, that moment against Valtteri? And I'm interested also in how Mercedes and Toto dealt with that, because that was almost the first time that maybe there was a difficult
when we came together, and obviously crashing into the driver whose seat you're trying to take and the team who have supported you your whole career.
That wasn't on the plan.
It wasn't. It definitely wasn't on the plan, but I think it's where those sort of killer instincts come in, because I was a Williams driver. The thing with Williams is I'd been there for 2 years. We'd scored 0 points. The teams who finish 8th, 9th, 10th in the championship, they often don't score more than 10 points in a whole season. So if you ever get that one opportunity to score 1 or 2 points, that is huge for the team. And also financially, if you could finish 9th or 8th in the Constructors' Championship, you're talking tens of millions of dollars in prize money extra you're given. So this is a team that's struggling to survive, on the brink of bankruptcy. I'm in a race, I'm in 11th position. And when you're in a car like that, you've got to put it all on the line. You're not going to score points if you're conservative and play Mr. Consistent. It didn't even really cross my mind that it was Valtteri and a Mercedes. That was an opening to score points for myself, for my team, and I had to go for it. But it was probably that moment I was spinning sideways through the grass at 200 miles an hour.
What did you think when you realised who it was that you'd had a coming together with?
It was quite a scary moment because I'd never crashed at that speed before. I was doing 330 kilometres an hour, DRS open, got on a wet patch, and the car just spun. And I'm going sideways down the track, carbon fibre flying everywhere. I can't see to my right because you're kind of locked in the cockpit. I don't know what I'm going to hit, and I'm sort of bracing for impact. Fortunately enough, the overall impact wasn't too bad, and we sort of slowed down into the gravel and hit the barrier slightly. Your initial reaction, you got so much adrenaline. As I said, you're crashing at 200 miles an hour. Firstly, I was furious with Valtteri, which was probably not the right thing to do because that was an opportunity that I saw that has now just disappeared. You know, it wasn't that I've just crashed into Valtteri or Mercedes. It's that is points we've lost. And I thought that he'd lost for us. And that was probably also a lesson for me that you need to look at the overall picture from other people's view before taking a snap judgment. And I was, you know, very hot-headed and went over, and yeah, he was also hot-headed, you know, middle fingers were flying and the F and the C words were being thrown around, and it was all a bit of a not a very pleasant situation. And that was also a really good learning for me. You need to take a moment to think about it before snap judgments. But when it comes to Mercedes, I didn't really know what to think. I was flying home with Toto that evening. It was always the case. So, you know, the one flight that I take with him a year, it was that one. He was very upset with the situation and pretty angry also because that was the very first year of this new financial cost cap that had been implemented, and the damage that occurred in that incident for Mercedes was, I think, $1.5 million. So that's $1.5 million taken away from the sort of overall budget. So he was obviously very upset and frustrated about that. It was all just a messy, not a good situation. We left it for the following day, and then I went around his house for lunch on Saturday, and everything was no problem at all, and we moved on from it. So I feel like situations like that, you almost grow together. It sort of pulls you closer, and I actually, as it happened, built a probably closer relationship with Valtteri's group of engineers and team, because I knew them already. But they all knew that there was a potential that I'd be replacing him. They're actually my team today. And I, you know, went over, I called them all and said, look, I'm really sorry for what happened on Sunday. You know, there's a lot of work just for the mechanic.
You got them together?
No, it was only sort of the chief mechanic and chief engineer for him. So I spoke to them both, just, you know, really sorry for how that panned out. And they said, look, don't worry about it. And
was that suggested by Toto? Or
no, it was, to be honest, I'm not too sure where it came from. I knew all of these guys anyway because I was a junior driver for Mercedes. So, you know, I'd often flown with the Mercedes team. I had a good relationship with everyone. So it wasn't a sort of difficult thing to come by. But obviously a strange dynamic. I'm a Williams driver crashing into a Mercedes driver. And then I'm sort of on the phone to the Mercedes team saying, look, I'm sorry for how that panned out. But, you know, I'm almost glad for that crash because I feel better for it. You know, I feel a more rounded person. I see things maybe slightly differently. And these moments in life, I guess, mature you. There's no perfect moments and you need mistakes to grow.
Was there ever a fear from you that it would cost you to drive?
No.
Yeah.
To be honest, because my argument was, you know, I was in a position that was better than where the Williams should be, and he was in a position worse than where the Mercedes should be at the time. So I kind of naively and selfishly used that incident as almost an argument for me.
A chance to remind them that their current driver was further back than he should have
been. Yeah. So you can look at it from so many different angles, and whether the crash was my fault, whether it wasn't his fault, but there was an opportunity there. It was a very audacious overtake attempt. And Toto actually said, you know, a couple of days later, he admired the fact that when I was sort of spinning out, I was still flat out on the throttle, going sideways through the grass towards the wall at 200 miles an hour, and sort of said that shows the sort of driver who I am. So even though from these difficult negative situations, there's always a positive that comes from it.
I'm intrigued by that journey back with Toto the night after that crash, and I'm hearing parallels of the journey back with your dad and your mum in the car after those weekends when you're not getting KFC.
Yeah.
And that one leads me to want to explore that relationship and the parallels between your dad and Toto.
I've seen some videos of Toto with his son go-karting recently, and there probably are some parallels there between my father and Toto as a father to his son. But
like what?
I think you live this with your son in that journey. So if they're not succeeding, you're also not succeeding. And that was the case when I was sort of driving. If I didn't win a race, that was obviously a failure for me, and I felt that, but my father felt that. But I think then when you've got that added personal investment, you know, at the time for my father, it was the financial side, you know, it was whether I've had a crash and damaged the cart or just not won the race. You almost feel like, what was all that work? What I spent, you know, God knows how much for nothing. For Toto during the race weekend, it's obviously he's, you know, he part owns the team, but also he's there to win. And that incident was going to compromise the team slightly for the season. So he felt that frustration as well, and almost disappointment. So we almost both felt the failures as such, but for different reasons.
Sure.
So in a way, you know, when I came back from the kart track with my father and I hadn't won, I was upset, but he was sort of very upset. That was kind of similar with Toto and I. You know, I was obviously upset the fact that I had lost points for Williams. He was very upset that I had had the crash, probably how I conducted myself, but more so the fact that Valtteri didn't score points and it's damaged the cars and the team's going to have to work a lot harder and it's going to potentially compromise their season slightly. So yeah, there's definitely some parallels, no doubt.
Because when we interviewed Just Capito, he spoke to us about his dad was similar, as in he'd funded him when he was coming through the ranks, and he described how his dad wouldn't speak to him for a week if he lost. And he now has this mantra that second place is nowhere.
Yeah.
That you either win or you're nothing. And he described how that was actually a real source of strength to him through his career. Do you think that gave you strength, or do you think you could have benefited from, say, having a, like your dad or Toto, actually put an arm around your shoulder and comfort you and help you process that loss?
At the time, I definitely didn't think it was, I didn't think it was beneficial. But now I look back and I really do. I definitely would not have changed one single way how my father raised me and took care of me during my karting career. And even on those times where, you know, there were tears, you know, for sure, as a young kid, and you feel like you've let your dad down. But that definitely made me stronger. And you always want that love and affection, of course, but what was I chasing in my life? Was I chasing love and affection, or was I chasing trying to be a Formula One world champion?
Well, I'm intrigued as how it affects your wider relationships now. Like if you're in a, like with a partner and they're upset, like we often learn from our parents or the example around us.
Yeah.
Do you have the capacity to be able to comfort people when they're struggling, or is it more that same mindset of just get on with it?
I mean, Toto said to me after that crash, you know, I am hardest on the ones I care about most. And yeah, that sort of resonated with me a little bit. And you know, whether, you know, my girlfriend or my family or whatever, if they're going through a tough time, whether it's work or personal, whatever, I think you need to strike that right balance. You know, my girlfriend works in finance. It's definitely not an easy industry to work in, a lot of long hours. And, you know, after a tough day, of course you want to give love and affection and put your arm around them. But equally, I want to see her succeed and I know what she's capable of. And sometimes you do need someone to look at things from a different perspective. And you know, my father, he, with his mentality, he's been hard on me because he only wants the best for me. And I totally agree and believe in that. And it might be something in the time you don't recognize, but I guess you may be thankful for later down the line.
Yeah, we often have a phrase, because this is a very common conversation with people who've reached your level in life, that just because something is hard for you doesn't mean it's bad for you.
No, absolutely.
And I think we've gone through many moments that have been hard but not bad.
I've learned the most in my life from my failures and my most difficult moments. I feel like success and victory is such an easy thing to deal with. No one needs to know how to celebrate a success. If you achieve something, you're elated, you're so happy, let's go and celebrate, let's have a glass of champagne or whatever. But often you don't sort of take away any learnings from that. And in the moment, it feels so great and you feel like you've accomplished so much. But perhaps it's not going to add much benefit later down the line. Maybe it will, and you'll continue on that path, and great if you do. But those failures are the times where you really question yourself, your processes. Am I doing this right? Could I be doing this better? I don't want to experience that ever again. I get more motivation from failing to never feel that again than when I do from succeeding. You know, I've not had a lot of success this season, but when I scored pole position in Hungary, that was such an elation and such a great feeling. I obviously had motivation to, I want to achieve that again and experience that. But if I compare it with Singapore or Silverstone, when I had a terrible race weekend, I feel stronger about not having the weekends like Silverstone and Singapore than having that success.
So what's more effective for you, playing like racing to win or racing not to lose?
It's definitely all about racing to win. But I think in terms of your progress, you need to lose to be able to win. And I think this year, I've had some failure. I've had a small amount of success. Across the road, it's been quite a Mercedes. We're here to win. They've won the championship for the last 8 years. And obviously, we've yet to score a victory this season. So that's not been where we've wanted to achieve. But we've been very consistent. We've achieved the results. And we've been solid. But we're not here to be solid. We are here to win. And I think you need to put it all on the line sometimes to get it right. But equally, when you get it wrong, that's where you progress the most, in my opinion.
I wonder whether actually the speed of the Mercedes has been a benefit to you this year. Because I'm sure that when you first went out in pre-season, you were like, oh, this is the title-winning car. This isn't going to win a title. But if you and Lewis were battling for race wins, battling for titles, then very quickly you can have a divide. Very quickly, you've seen it. We've all seen it over the years. Whereas actually, when you have a car that is second, third, fourth fastest, and you want to get first, second fastest, the only way to do that is unity, working together, collaboration, understanding, empathy, compassion for each other. So can we talk about that?
Yeah, 100%. I think for sure the dynamic would have been slightly different had we arrived at the first race and had the fastest car on the grid. There's been a huge amount of late nights throughout this season, a lot of tension at times between drivers, teams, designers, with regards to, are we on the right tracks? Do we need to be doing something different? Do we need to be more drastic? And these were very sort of difficult conversations, but we come away from them growing closer together. And we've got, you know, such great leadership within Mercedes that we are now all pushing in one direction. I truly believe this experience we've been through this year will lead to more long-term success.
I want to talk to you about when you first shared the team with Lewis, because one of the standout things for me in this conversation is how you've learned all the time from everything, good, bad, successful, unsuccessful. You are a sponge of information from others. What would you say 3/4 of the way through your first season with Lewis is the thing you've learned the most from someone that has won as many world titles as him?
Lewis is an incredibly unique character. I think he's incredibly inspiring with all of his sort of activities and projects he has off circuit. When you look at maybe drivers from the past who are just pure racing drivers, I'm going to wake up living and breathing this sport. And he does things so differently to so many other people, yet has still had so much success along the way.
You mean he doesn't fit in the traditional mold of how a Formula One driver
is? I'd say so. And yet he still had so much success. And I think I've used this analogy before, but when I look at Federer, Nadal and Djokovic, you know, these are three greats of the sport. Statistically, you know, they've all basically achieved exactly the same achievements. Yet they have three totally different ways of playing. I'm sure they train differently. When you watch them, they look different. When you see them on court, you know, they excel on different courts or playing fields or whatever. Yet they're three greats. And I think the thing I take away from that, and also from what I take away from Lewis, is that there is no one path to success. I think you need to find your own path, your own journey. You need to have that self-belief that even if somebody is going down a certain path, you need to follow your own course and you need to do what is best for you.
I was going to ask, you referenced the tennis players Federer, Nadal and Djokovic, and I think we see lots of parallels there. Formula One's a sport where there's no coaches.
Yeah.
Now, I know you recently spent some time with Federer and Andy Murray. What did that teach you? What did you learn from that experience of meeting those guys?
I think what I learned is that, firstly, they are just great, humble, grounded people. And I think this is something we can never forget. I think we all live this crazy lifestyle, especially Formula One. You're going to, you know, 23 different countries. The fans there are incredible. You're racing, you know, these machines around racetracks over 200 miles an hour. You're in this bubble of something that isn't real life to a degree. And I think meeting somebody like Roger, who has gone through so much success, so much fame along the way, yet is still just such a down-to-earth, humble guy, gave me so much respect for him. And, you know, hearing, you know, where he lives and what he gets up to on his sort of day-to-day life, spending a lot of time with the family, it sort of brings it back to you that you need this in your routine. You need that element of something that, you know, something that, you know, takes you away from it all, so you can come back and perform at your very, very best. And
what's yours?
I think for me, it's spending time with my family and friends. When I come back from a racetrack, to be honest, the place where I'd like to be is always my parents' house in the countryside, away from everything, no phone signal, and just really sort of disconnect and sort of spend quality time with the people who I care about the most.
When I was working in Formula One, Jenson Button was, you know, winning world titles, and he had a very tight group of mates that went absolutely everywhere with him, and they were like his safety net. And I know that you work with your sister. She's been part of your kind of backroom setup, and you don't make a big deal of it. You know, we don't see her on the telly or anything, but I wonder whether that is a kind of that constant grounding for you at a race weekend, that that person that was there right back in the karting days is still there
absolutely.
For you.
As you say, I work with my sister and she's always there for me 24/7, even though, you know, most of the time when we talk, it's professional. We're not talking as brother and sister. Having her there is someone who I've had for 24 years of my life. And also my manager, Harry. Harry was my manager from when I left go-karting in 2013. He was there from day one. When I signed for Mercedes, they took over everything. So Harry and I sort of parted way for a couple of years. And 2 years ago, I said to the team at Mercedes, I'd really like to bring Harry back into sort of my group of people around, because he's somebody who I trust so much and who I think would be really beneficial for me trying to sort of grow on my journey. So, you know, having my sister, having Harry, having my family, these are people who have always been there from day one, and you know what they're about.
Do you have any agreement in place that when you're getting a little bit carried away or you have gone too far down the rabbit hole of this fantasy world that you live in, do they have anything in place to be able to pull you back out?
I don't think so. I think I've never fortunately found myself in that position. And you know, I try and speak with my family as much as possible, and I think that helps to stay grounded.
And before we do our quick fire questions, I just want to know whether you're remembering to really enjoy it as well. I remember, you know, it was Lando, wasn't it, a while ago, he was tongue in cheek, he said, "You're not fun anymore." When you got into Formula One, it is so serious. The stakes are so high. We've had a conversation about a crash that cost the team that you wanted to drive for $1.5 million. Like, is there still space for enjoyment and for fun, or is it all too high a level for that?
I joked with him that it was quite fun standing on the podium 7 times this year to his one. But anyway,
yeah, it's
no, of course there's time for fun, but yeah. It's all got to be in the right moments.
Right. Quick fire questions. What are the 3 non-negotiables that you and the people around you have to buy into to be part of your world?
I think you need to accept that I'm going to be incredibly dedicated to what I do. Can't be a dick. Got to be a nice person. And definitely got to be humble and not get carried away with what we're doing.
What's your biggest weakness and what's your greatest strength?
I'd say my biggest weakness is probably in the heat of the moment, blaming others before looking at myself. I think it's very easy to have tunnel vision, and especially in the heat of battle. And if something goes wrong, goes against you, I think it's quite easy to jump onto that other person. Biggest strength, I think probably being dynamic to a situation. Our life is constantly changing, whether it's travel plans, whether it's racing on track, one day it's drier, one day it's wet, climates are changing, conditions are changing, time zones are changing. You can't have a strict routine in the sport that we do, and you've got to be dynamic. You've got to accept that things will change.
What's the hidden cost of the life that you live?
There's a lot of sacrifice on not only you, but probably the people around you, the emotions you go through. Once again, it's not just you. It's everyone is on this journey with you. Yeah, I'd say, yeah, probably the biggest hidden cost is that emotion. I see the effect it has on the people I'm closest to when I succeed. And that's such a great sort of elation and feeling to see that you've had this positive impact on the people you love the most. But when something goes against you, or you have a bad weekend, or you fail, I see this on the people around me as well.
Yeah.
So you're probably carrying that weight.
And just to take on from that, the conversation about mental health is an important one for men to have. How much does what you do challenge your mental health?
It absolutely challenges your mental health so much, and you've got to be so resilient to the negativity in this world, whether it's the public perception, whether it's social media, whether it's the pressures of the team, or even the pressures of yourself. But I think the biggest one probably for me is that public perception and social media side, which is a tough one. And I think that's also relatable to people who aren't in the spotlight, because social media is a pretty ruthless platform.
And what have you learned to deal with it?
Just don't read comments. That's a pretty straightforward, simple one. But talking to a professional, I think I have a psychologist who I talk to. It's not routinely, but I always pick up the phone whenever I feel like I need it. And I always leave that conversation feeling better about myself. There's sort of a weight lifted off my shoulders. And I think, you know, a number of people have said this before. It's the same way as if you want to get fitter, you go to the gym and you speak to a personal trainer. If there's anything weighing on your mind, you need to talk to a professional about it and seek that help.
But also, you know, you go to the gym when your body's not broken.
Yeah.
And I think people will often only go and seek professional help when the mind is broken. And I think there's a power there that you don't go and see someone when you're at your lowest ebb.
Absolutely.
They're there all the time for you if you need it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I've been very lucky to have the right people around me to almost push me to do this. You know, even though I'm in a good place right now, let's just keep it going. Let's keep the conversations on going. And often I've been in a good place, but as soon as that conversation starts, you know, it sort of all flows out. So yeah, I think that's a really good analogy.
If you don't mind us being intrusive and you don't have to answer this, what would you say has been the biggest lesson you've learned from those conversations with the psychologist?
The conversation with the psychologist, it's, for me, it's difficult to put into words because they are truly experts within their field. And I always, you know, come away from a conversation with my psychologist, and whether I talk to my girlfriend or my family, and they just, oh, how was that? I try and explain some of the things that we spoke about and the piece of advice that he gave me, but I actually struggle to say it, but it's because that's what they're so good at. And I said, I can't really describe what it was that he said or how he said it, but I feel better for it. And I would really recommend anybody who's got the opportunity to talk to a professional, even if you've never done it before, just go out there and just give it a try and see what you think. And I think you'd be really surprised at what you can take from it.
Brilliant. The power of talking. What we've done for the last little while, and a really fascinating conversation where we haven't really spoken that much about the mechanics of Formula One, but it's been great just hearing that people from the outside see a very linear journey from go-karting to Formula One driving, and the fact that it isn't that, which you've explained so well, but you've explained the lessons you've taken from all of those difficult moments, which has you where you are.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, mate. Damien.
Jake.
I worked for a long time in Formula One. That is the best understanding that I've ever heard a driver offer into the journey that is involved in getting to Formula One and the importance of having those bad times, having those tough times. You know, I remember watching that crash with Valtteri, and for him to then sit here and talk about it in a way where it was almost a positive. He learned from it. That is such a powerful place to get your mind to, I think.
Yeah, I think there was something really inherently powerful about the messages he was talking about. Pretty much every situation is a learning experience if you're open to that, if you're willing to, as he said, step back from the emotion of it, review it in a really detached, calm, rational way, and take the lessons from it. We can all learn from pretty much every experience then.
And in an interesting way, he learned how to learn, if that makes sense. So, you know, I loved it when he talked about in the early days, it was all about victory, all about success. And then you have to realise that actually, when you qualify second on the grid for the first time in a Mercedes and you're disappointed, something's not right. And most drivers would go, well, that's the sport, that's the way it is, that's elite. He doesn't accept that. Like, he's clearly constantly exploring why he feels the way he feels and whether it's healthy for him. Yeah. And I love the fact he learned that coming second on the grid in his first ever race for Mercedes when he stood in for Lewis should have been a good moment, and it was a bad one, so he's corrected that. And do you remember he said right at the beginning, he said, oh, I had a bad weekend, laid in my room and got no sleep, maybe I'd have been better to go out with my mates. So it shows that even now he's picking up on things, even three or four days ago in the most recent race, that actually the way he dealt with it wasn't right, and he's continuing to explore.
Yeah, I think there's something really powerful here of getting off what's known as the hedonic treadmill, the idea of we're constantly going from, we're looking for the next thing and the next thing, because we never get off it then. Like he said, if you win one race, you want to win two, you want to win two, you want to win five, then you want to win the championship. And it's almost like you'll never get off that treadmill if that's what you're chasing after, happiness, whereas going for those smaller moments, like the delayed discounting of having your own expectations of coming half a second is a victory for you, rather than thinking that if I don't win the championship, I can't be happy.
And we talk often about, you know, people that delay their happiness, they'll be happy when they achieve something. Well, this guy's fighting for a Formula One world title in his career, and he's learned that he needs to be happy on the journey, not when he reaches that destination, because who knows, he may never reach it. And if someone where the stakes are so high, it's like this is, you know, global fame and millions of pounds worth of riches if you become a Formula One world champion. Well, if he's learned that that's not the everything, I think we can all learn in our own much more humble lives that it's about the daily stuff. It's not about the big moment.
Yeah, I think when people often hear, say, football coaches or racing drivers like George say, stick to the process, sometimes it's almost got to the place of a cliche where you go, well, what does that mean? He's just explained it to you there, the processes, the small steps that eventually add up to the performance targets that then achieve your outcome. But you focus on the small steps to feel that constant sense of motivation, engagement and happiness on the journey.
Fascinating. And look, we didn't have time to get into it, remarkably, after talking for that long. But, you know, when you talk to the team, he gets out there before other people, he acclimatizes, you know, his meticulous planning for a race weekend leaves no stone unturned. And I think that if that's how you approach life, then if it doesn't go to plan, you've allowed yourself the opportunity to actually explore it and find out what's gone on and not be too hard on yourself because you've done everything. And we're not saying like, don't bother and be happy. We're saying give it everything and be happy if it doesn't go to plan.
Yeah. And there was something about that first season when he drove for Williams where he said, you know, that in that race in Monaco where he could have cruised round and come in at 19th and been happy. And then he said, actually, what am I going to learn from this? I think there's so many things that if we have that mindset of curiosity, there's always something to teach us. I was reminded of a story. I think it was Gary Player, the golfer, said that when he wanted to teach himself patience, when he was driving to a golf course, he'd drive behind an articulated lorry in the slow lane. So he would deliberately force him to slow his breathing down, to just be patient and focus on the process rather than just getting there as quick as possible. And I think what George has just described of that learning is there in every opportunity if you have that curiosity and you're willing to explore.
Enjoyed that.
I loved it.
Okay, it's now time to meet a high-performance listener. One of the things that is really important to us is hearing from you, hearing from our high-performance community. And we get so many people reaching out to us, sharing their stories. How can we not put those people on the podcast? So let's do it. We had an amazing email from a guy called Stuart, but I'm not going to tell you his story. I'm going to let him do it. Hey, Stuart, how are you?
Not bad. How are you doing, Jake? You good?
Really well, thanks. Right, so please share with the listeners what happened to you one day that had a huge impact on your life.
Put simply, I nearly died. but more complicated, in a sort of a more informative way, was driving home after reporting at the Royal Cornwall Show. It was my first year as a trainee journalist. And another driver lost control of his car and sort of hit me head on, and I was conscious all the way to hospital, talking with the paramedics, and then was unresponsive from about 2:30 in the morning. And I suffered something which is quite rare, but in 80% of the cases is usually fatal, called fatty embolic syndrome, which is where you break a long bone and the bone marrow gets into your bloodstream. And yeah, was in a induced coma for 10 days, had to learn to like walk, talk, blink, eat everything again, had like speech and language therapist. But after six and a half, seven weeks, I think it was in hospital, got out and then got back to the job, within 12 weeks after the crash happening. So yeah, it was quite a miraculous event and very fortunate for the recovery that I was, you know, very, very lucky to benefit from, as I wouldn't be here.
And look, that's only part of the story, because that's you having a lifelong ambition to be a journalist, managing to achieve that by 22, but then at 23, almost dying. But then after that, you said in your email that your dog got really poorly. You were uninsured because your wife was about to start maternity leave and it was just simply too expensive. So instead, you opted to save money each month and squirrel it away for a just-in-case fund, which obviously was your ill dog. So would you mind sharing with the audience at that moment when you're struggling just to keep the wolf from the door, what you were doing for work?
Yeah, I had to basically take on two extra jobs on top of my full-time job to try having some extra money to pay for the dog's vet costs. So I was doing two cleaning jobs. I was cleaning all day on a Saturday and then cleaned a hospital on a Thursday, Friday and Saturday evening.
So look, struggling to make ends meet, recovering from your accident, yet you say in the message you sent us that as you were cleaning the hospital, you did it listening to the High Performance podcast. Tell me what the podcast did for you.
So when I was doing the extra work, I wanted to try utilizing that time in the most effective way possible by applying myself and learning, and you know, stumbled across the podcast, and it just completely just changed everything about, you know, my life and my outlook. I'm quite a positive person anyway, but it was getting those golden threads that you find in every episode where you extrapolate that information and apply it to yourself. Yeah, thank you, more than anything.
Well, look, thank you for coming on here, because I think it's one thing, Damien and I, telling people that life is about how you react to the things that happen, not the things that happen, right? And sometimes it's easy to say it. It's much more impactful to hear someone talk who has been through that journey. And for you to sit here and tell us about the accident, tell us about the extra jobs you had to take to support your wife and your child and your dog, and then for it finally to lead to an amazing opportunity and for us to help you get that job is the most incredible thing for us. And, you know, I will still say it again, this is all your work, not ours, but it's an absolute pleasure for you to come on here, share it with us and share it with the audience. Thank you so much, man.
That's all right. Thank you again.
Oh, what a cool episode. And I think it's one thing to hear it. It's something totally different to watch it. And you can see this conversation with George on our YouTube page. Just type High Performance Podcast into YouTube and you can watch the whole conversation. There's some extended bits on there as well, some really cool stuff. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for being part of this high performance journey. You know what? I would love you to just get in touch. I would love you to let me know what you thought of this conversation with George. And I'd love you to do one other thing. Let me just be totally frank here, okay? We are doing our best to change people's mindsets, change their perception of the world, change their outlook, change their understanding of others by having these conversations on High Performance. But, you know, we're not on a terrestrial TV channel. We don't spend millions of pounds on advertising. Not everyone knows about this podcast. So if you could do me one thing or one thing only, it's just to share this podcast on your WhatsApp, on your Instagram, on your Facebook, with your mates. Just call someone and say, listen, there's a cool podcast you should listen to. I can't tell you the difference it makes for us. The more we can grow this channel, the more incredible names we can attract. And once we get those names, we bring you conversations that will be a game changer for you. So please, please share this podcast. Thanks to the whole team for their hard work on this episode. But for you at home listening to this, remember, there is no secret. It's all there for you. So be like George, man. Believe in big things. Chase world-class basics. Work hard. Don't get high on your own supply. Remain humble, curious, and empathetic. And we'll see you soon. Bye for now.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.